15. They burst up and out of the earth like dragon's teeth. Boards flew away to either side of them, along with dry flurries of weeds and leaves. Roland and Eddie each had one of the big revolvers with the sandalwood grips. Jake had his father's Ruger. Margaret, Rosa, and Zelia each held a Risa. Susanna had two, her arms crossed over her breasts as though she were cold. The wolves were deployed exactly as Roland had seen them, with the cool killer's eye of his imagination, and he felt a moment of triumph before all lesser thought and emotion was swept away beneath the red curtain. As always, he was never so happy to be alive as when he was preparing to deal death. 5 minutes worth of blood and stupidity, he told them, and here those 5 minutes were. He'd also told them he always felt sick afterward, and while that was true enough, he never felt so fine as he did at this moment of beginning, never felt so completely and truly himself. Here were the tag ends of glory's old cloud. It didn't matter that they were robots, gods, no. What mattered was that they had been preying on the helpless for generations, and this time they had been caught utterly and completely by surprise. "Top of the hoods!" Eddie screamed, as in his right hand Roland's pistol began to thunder and spit fire. The harnessed horses and mules reared in the traces. A couple screamed in surprise, "Top of the hoods, get the thinking caps!" And, as if to demonstrate his point, the green hoods of three riders to the right of the path twitched as if plucked by invisible fingers. Each of the three beneath pitched bonelessly out of their saddles and struck the ground. In Grandpère's story of the wolf Molly Doolin had brought down, there had been a good deal of twitching afterward, but these three lay under the feet of their prancing horses as still as stones. Molly might not have hit the hidden thinking cap cleanly, but Eddie knew what he was shooting for and had. Roland also began to fire, shooting from the hip, shooting almost casually, but each bullet found its mark. He was after the ones on the path, wanting to pile up bodies there to make a barricade if he could. "Risa flies true," Rosalita Munoz shrieked. The plate she was holding left her hand and bolted across the east road with an unremitting rising shriek. It clipped through the hood of a rider at the head of the Arroyo path who was trying desperately to rein his horse around. The thing fell backward, feet up to heaven, and landed upside down with its boots in the road. "Risa!" That was Margaret Eisenhart. "For my brother," Zelia cried. "Lady Risa, come for your asses, you bastards." Susanna uncrossed her arms and threw both plates outward. They flew, screaming, crisscrossed in midair, and both found their mark. Scraps of green hooding fluttered down. The wolves to whom the hoods had belonged fell faster and harder. Bright rods of fire now glowed in the morning light as the jostling, struggling riders on either side of the path unsheathed their energy weapons. Jake shot the thinking cap of the first one to unsheathe, and it fell on its own bitterly sizzling sword, catching its cloak afire. Its horse shied sideways into the descending light stick of the rider to the direct left. Its head came off, disclosing a nest of sparks and wires. Now the sirens began to blat steadily, burglar alarms in hell. Roland had thought the wolves closest to town might try to break off and flee toward the Cala. Instead, the nine on that side still left, Eddie had taken six with his first six shots, spurred past the buckas and directly toward them. Two or three hurled humming silvery balls. "Eddie, Jake, Sneetches, you're right." They swung in that direction immediately, leaving the women, who were hurling plates as fast as they could pull them from their silk-lined bags. Jake was standing with his legs spread and the Ruger held out in his right hand, his left bracing his right wrist. His hair was blowing back from his brow. He was wide-eyed and handsome, smiling. He squeezed off three quick shots, each one a whip-crack in the morning air. He had a vague, distant memory of the day in the woods when he had shot pottery out of the sky. Now he was shooting at something far more dangerous, and he was glad, glad. The first three of the flying balls exploded in brilliant flashes of bluish light. A fourth jinked, then zipped straight at him. Jake ducked and heard it pass just above his head, humming like some sort of pissed-off toaster oven. It would turn, he knew, and come back. Before it could, Susanna swiveled and fired a plate at it. The plate flew straight to the mark, howling. When it struck, both it and the Sneetch exploded. Shrapnel rained down in the corn plants, setting some of them alight. Roland reloaded, the smoking barrel of his revolver momentarily pointed down between his feet. Beyond Jake, Eddie was doing the same. A wolf jumped the tangled heap of bodies at the head of the arroyo path, its green cloak floating out behind it, and one of Rosa's plates tore back its hood, for a moment revealing the radar dish beneath. The thinking caps of the bear's retinue had been moving slowly and jerkily. This one was spinning so fast, its shape was only a metallic blur. Then it was gone, and the wolf went tumbling to the side and onto the team which had drawn Overholzer's lead wagon. The horses flinched backward, shoving the bucca into the one behind, mashing four whinnying, rearing animals between. These tried to bolt, but had nowhere to go. Overholzer's bucca teetered, then overturned. The downed wolf's horse gained the road, stumbled over the body of another wolf lying there, and went sprawling in the dust, one of its legs jutting off crookedly to the side. Roland's mind was gone. His eye saw everything. He was reloaded. The wolves who had gone up the path were pinned behind a tangled heap of bodies, just as he had hoped. The group of 15 on the town side had been decimated, only two left. Those on the right were trying to flank the end of the ditch where the three sisters of Oriza and Susanna anchored their line. Roland left the remaining two wolves on his side to Eddie and Jake, sprinted down the trench to stand behind Susanna and began firing at the 10 remaining wolves bearing down on them. One raised a sneech to throw, then dropped it as Roland's bullet snapped off its thinking cap. Rosa took another one, Margaret Eisenhart a third. Margaret dipped to get another plate. When she stood up again, a light stick swept off her head, setting her hair on fire as it tumbled into the ditch. And Benny's reaction was understandable. She had been almost a second mother to him. When the burning head landed beside him, he batted it aside and scrambled out of the ditch, blind with panic, howling in terror. "Benny, no, get back!" Jake cried. Two of the remaining wolves threw their silver death balls at the crawling, screaming boy. Jake shot one out of the air. He never had a chance at the other. It struck Benny Sleitman in the chest, and the boy simply exploded outward. One arm tearing free of his body and landing palm up in the road. Susanna cut the thinking cap off the wolf which had killed Margaret with one plate, then did for the one who had killed Jake's friend with another. She pulled two fresh risers from her sacks and turned back to the oncoming wolves just as the first one leaped into the ditch, its horse's chest knocking Roland asprawl. It brandished its sword over the gunslinger. To Susanna, it looked like a brilliant red-orange tube of neon. "No, you don't, Muffa!" she screamed and slung the plate in her right hand. It sheared through the gleaming saber, and the weapon simply exploded at the hilt, tearing off the wolf's arm. The next moment, one of Rosa's plates amputated its thinking cap, and it tumbled sideways and crashed to the ground, its gleaming mask grinning at the paralyzed, terrified Tavery twins who lay clinging to each other. A moment later, it began to smoke and melt. Shrieking Benny's name, Jake walked across the east road, reloading the Ruger as he went, tracking through his dead friend's blood without realizing it. To his left, Roland, Susanna, and Rosa were putting paid to the five remaining wolves in what had been the raiding party's north wing. The raiders whirled their horses in jerky, useless circles, seeming unsure what to do in circumstances such as these. "Want some company, kid?" Eddie asked him. On their right, the group of wolves who had been stationed on the town side of the arroyo path all lay dead. Only one of them had actually made it as far as the ditch. That one lay with its hooded head plowed into the freshly turned earth of the hide and its booted feet in the road. The rest of its body was wrapped in its green cloak. It looked like a bug that has died in its cocoon. "Sure," Jake said. Was he talking or only thinking? He didn't know. The sirens blasted the air. "Whatever you want. They killed Benny." "I know. That sucks."
"It should have been his fucking father," Jake said.
Was he crying? He didn't know.
"Agreed. Have a present."
Into Jake's hand, Eddie dropped a couple of balls about 3 inches in diameter. The surfaces looked like steel, but when Jake squeezed, he felt some give. It was like squeezing a child's toy made out of hard, hard rubber. A small plate on the side read, "Sneech. Harry Potter, registered, Model. Serial number 465-11-AA-HPJKR. Caution. Explosive. To the left of the plate was a button. A distant part of Jake's mind wondered who Harry Potter was. The Sneetch's inventor, more than likely. They reached the heap of dead wolves at the head of the Arroyo Path. Perhaps machines couldn't really be dead, but Jake was unable to think of them as anything else, tumbled and tangled as they were. Dead. Yes. And he was savagely glad. From behind them came an explosion, followed by a shriek of either extreme pain or extreme pleasure. For the moment, Jake didn't care which. All his attention was focused on the remaining wolves trapped on the Arroyo Path. There were somewhere between 18 and 24 of them. There was one wolf out in front, its sizzling fire stick raised. It was half turned to its mates, and now it waved its light stick at the road. Except that's no light stick, Eddie thought. That's a lightsaber, just like the ones in the Star Wars movies. Only these lightsabers aren't special effects, they really kill. What the hell's going on here? Well, the guy out front was trying to rally his troops, that much seemed clear. Eddie decided to cut the sermon short. He thumbed the button in one of the three Sneetches he had kept for himself. The thing began to hum and vibrate in his hand. It was sort of like holding a joy buzzer. "Hey, sunshine!" he called. The head wolf didn't look around, and so Eddie simply lobbed the Sneetch at it. Thrown as easily as it was, it should have struck the ground 20 or 30 yards from the cluster of remaining wolves and rolled to a stop. It picked up speed instead, rose, and struck the head wolf dead center in its frozen snarl of a mouth. The thing exploded from the neck up, thinking cap and all. "Go on," Eddie said. "Try it. Using their own shit against them has its own special pla—" Ignoring him, Jake dropped the Sneetch as Eddie had given him, stumbled over the heap of bodies, and started up the path. "Jake? Jake, I don't think that's such a good idea." A hand gripped Eddie's upper arm. He whirled, raising his gun, then lowering it again when he saw Roland. "He can't hear you," the gunslinger said. "Come on, we'll stand with him."
"Wait, Roland, wait."
It was Rosa. She was smeared with blood, and Eddie assumed it was poor Cy Eisenhart's. He could see no wound on Rosa herself.
"I want some of this," she said.
16. They reached Jake just as the remaining wolves made their last charge, a few through Sneetches. These Roland and Eddie picked out of the air easily. Jake fired the Ruger in 9 steady, spaced shots, right wrist clasped in left hand, and each time he fired, one of the wolves either flipped backward out of its saddle or went sliding over the side to be trampled by the horses coming behind. When the Ruger was empty, Rosa took a 10th, screaming Lady Oriza's name. Zelia Jaffords had also joined them, and the 11th fell to her. While Jake reloaded the Ruger, Roland and Eddie, standing side by side, went to work. They almost certainly could have taken the remaining 8 between them. It didn't much surprise Eddie that there had been 19 in this last cluster, but they left the last 2 for Jake. As they approached, swinging their light swords over their heads in a way that would have been undoubtedly terrifying to a bunch of farmers, the boy shot the thinking cap off the one on the left. Then he stood aside, dodging as the last surviving wolf took a half-hearted swing at him. Its horse leaped the pile of bodies at the end of the path. Susanna was on the far side of the road, sitting on her haunches, amid a litter of fallen green-cloaked machinery and melting, rotting masks. She was also covered in Margaret Eisenhart's blood. Roland understood that Jake had left the final one for Susanna, who would have found it extremely difficult to join them on the Arroyo Path because of her missing lower legs. The gunslinger nodded. The boy had seen a terrible thing this morning. Suffered a terrible shock. But Roland thought he would be all right. Oi, waiting for them back at the pair's rectory house, would no doubt help him through the worst of his grief.
"Lady Oriza!" Susanna screamed and flung one final plate as the wolf reined its horse around, turning it east toward whatever it called home.
The plate rose, screaming, and clipped off the top of the green hood. For a moment, this last child thief sat in its saddle, shuddering and blaring out its alarm, calling for help that couldn't come.
Then it snapped violently backward, turning a complete somersault in midair and thudded to the road, its siren cut off in mid-whoop.
And so, Roland thought, our 5 minutes are over. He looked dully at the smoking barrel of his revolver, then dropped it back into its holster. One by one, the alarms issuing from the downed robots were stopping. Zelia was looking at him with a kind of dazed incomprehension.
Roland, she said.
Yes, Zelia.
Are they gone? Can they be gone, really?
All gone, Roland said. I counted 61, and they all lie here or on the road or in our ditch.
For a moment, Tian's wife only stood there, processing this information. Then she did something that surprised a man who was not often surprised. She threw herself against him, pressing her body frankly to his, and covered his face with hungry, wet-lipped kisses. Roland bore this for a little bit, then held her away. The sickness was coming now. The feeling of uselessness. The sense that he would fight this battle, or battles like it, over and over for eternity. Losing a finger to the Lobstrosities here, perhaps an eye to a clever old witch there. And after each battle he would sense the dark tower a little farther away instead of a little closer. And all the time, the dry twist would work its way in toward his heart. Stop that, he told himself. It's nonsense and you know it.
Will they send more, Roland? Rosa asked.
They may have no more to send, Roland said. If they do, there'll almost certainly be fewer of them. And now you know the secret to killing them, don't you?
Yes, she said, and gave him a savage grin. Her eyes promised him more than kisses later on, if he'd have her.
Go down through the corn, he told her, you and Zelia both. Tell them it's safe to come up now. Lady Oriza has stood friend to the Kala this day, and to the line of Eld as well.
Will you not come yourself? Zelia asked him. She had stepped away from him, and her cheeks were filled with fire. Will you not come and let him cheer you?
Perhaps later on we may all hear them cheer us, Roland said. Now we need to speak and Tet. The boys had a bad shock, you can.
Yes, Rosa said. Yes, all right. Come on, Z. She reached out and took Zelia's hand. Help me be the bearer of glad tidings.
17. The two women crossed the road, making a wide berth around the tumbled, bloody remains of the poor Slightman lad. Zelia thought that most of what was left of him was only held together by his clothes, and shivered to think of the father's grief. The young man's shore-leg Lady Sai was at the far north end of the ditch, examining the bodies of the wolves scattered there. She found one where the little revolving thing hadn't been entirely shot off and was still trying to turn. The wolf's green-gloved hands shivered uncontrollably in the dust as if with palsy. While Rosa and Zelia watched, Susanna picked up a largish chunk of rock and, cool as a night in wide earth, brought it down on the remains of the thinking cap. The wolf stilled immediately. The low hum that had been coming from it stopped.
We go to tell the others, Susanna, Rosa said, but first we want to tell thee well done. How we do love thee, say true.
Zelia nodded.
We say thank you, Susanna of New York. We say thank you more big than could ever be told.
Yar, say true, Rosa agreed.
The Lady Sai looked up at them and smiled sweetly. For a moment, Rosalita looked a little doubtful, as if maybe she saw something in that dark brown face that she shouldn't. Saw that Susanna Dean was no longer here, for instance. Then the expression of doubt was gone.
We go with good news, Susanna, said she.
Wish you joy of it, said Mia, daughter of Nun. Bring them back as you will. Tell them the danger here is over, and let those who don't believe count the dead.
The legs of your pants are wet, do you? Zelia said.
Mia nodded gravely. Another contraction had turned her belly to a stone, but she gave no sign.
"'Tis blood, I'm afraid.
She nodded toward the headless body of the big rancher's wife.
Hers. The women started down through the corn, hand in hand. Mia watched Roland, Eddie, and Jake cross the road toward her. This would be the dangerous time right here. Yet perhaps not too dangerous after all. Susanna's friends looked dazed in the aftermath of the battle. If she seemed a little off her feed, perhaps they would think the same of her. She thought mostly it would be a matter of waiting her opportunity, waiting and then slipping away. In the meantime, she rode the contraction of her belly like a boat riding a high wave. "They'll know where you went," a voice whispered. It wasn't a head voice, but a belly voice. The voice of the chap. And that voice spoke true. "Take the ball with you," the voice told her. "Take it with you when you go. Leave them no door to follow you through. I." 18. The Ruger cracked out a single shot, and a horse died. From below the road, from the rice, came a rising roar of joy that was not quite disbelieving. Zelia and Rosa had given their good news. Then a shrill cry of grief cut through the mingled voices of happiness. They had given the bad as well. Jake Chambers sat on the wheel of the overturned wagon. He had unharnessed the three horses that were okay. The fourth had been lying with two broken legs, foaming helplessly through its teeth and looking to the boy for help. The boy had given it. Now he sat, staring at his dead friend. Benny's blood was soaking into the road. A hand on the end of Benny's arm lay palm up, as if the dead boy wanted to shake hands with God. What God? According to current rumor, the top of the Dark Tower was empty. From Lady Oriza's rice came a second scream of grief. Which had been Sleitman, which Von Eisenhart? At a distance, Jake thought you couldn't tell the rancher from the foreman, the employer from the employee. Was there a lesson there, or was it what Miss Avery, back at good old Piper, would have called fear, false evidence appearing real? The palm pointing up to the brightening sky, that was certainly real. Now the Falcon began to sing. Jake recognized the song. It was a new version of the one Roland had sung on their first night in Calabrin Sturgis. Come, come, Kamala, rice come a falla, Isissa ea brala, de come a falla, we went to a river, Riza did us kiva. The rice swayed with the passage of the singing falcon, swayed as if it were dancing for their joy, as Roland had danced for them that torchlit night. Some came with babbies in their arms, and even so burdened, they swayed from side to side. We all danced this morning, Jake thought. He didn't know what he meant, only that it was a true thought. The dance we do. The only one we know. Benny Sleitman died dancing. Cy Eisenhart, too. Roland and Eddie came over to him. Susanna, too, but she hung back a bit, as if deciding that, at least for the time being, the boys should be with the boys. Roland was smoking, and Jake nodded at it. Roll me one of those, would you? Roland turned in Susanna's direction, eyebrows raised. She shrugged, then nodded. Roland rolled Jake a cigarette, gave it to him, then scratched a match on the seat of his pants and lit it. Jake sat on the wagon wheel, taking the smoke in occasional puffs, holding it in his mouth and letting it out. His mouth filled up with spit. He didn't mind. Unlike some things, spit could be got rid of. He made no attempt to inhale. Roland looked down the hill, where the first of the two running men was just entering the corn. "That's Sleitman," he said. "Good." "Why good, Roland?" Eddie asked. "Because Cy Sleitman will have accusations to make," Roland said. "In his grief, he isn't going to care who hears them, or what his extraordinary knowledge might say about his part in this morning's work." "Dance," Jake said. They turned to look at him. He sat pale and thoughtful on the wagon wheel, holding a cigarette. "This morning's dance," he said. Roland appeared to consider this, then nodded. "His part in this morning's dance. If he gets here soon enough, we may be able to quiet him. If not, his son's death is only going to be the start of Ben Sleitman's Kamala." 19. Sleitman was almost 15 years younger than the rancher and arrived at the site of the battle well before the other. For a moment he only stood on the far edge of the hide, considering the shattered body lying in the road. There was not so much blood now. The Ogun had drunk it greedily, but the severed arm still lay where it had been. And the severed arm told all. Roland would no more have moved it before Sleitman got here than he would have opened his flies and pissed on the boy's corpse. Sleitman the younger had reached the clearing at the end of his path. His father, as next of kin, had a right to see where and how it had happened. The man stood quiet for perhaps 5 seconds, then pulled in a deep breath and let it out in a shriek. It chilled Eddie's blood. He looked around for Susanna and saw she was no longer there. He didn't blame her for ducking out. This was a bad scene, the worst. Sleitman looked left, looked right, then looked straight ahead and saw Roland standing beside the overturned wagon with his arms crossed. Beside him, Jake still sat on the wheel, smoking his first cigarette. "You!" Sleitman screamed. He was carrying his bar. Now he unslung it. "You did this! You!" Eddie plucked the weapon deftly from Sleitman's hands. "No, you don't, partner," he murmured. "You don't need this right now. Why don't you let me keep it for you?" Sleitman seemed not to notice. Incredibly, his right hand still made circular motions in the air as if winding the bar for a shot. "You killed my son to pay me back, you bastard, murdering best." Moving with the eerie, spooky speed that Eddie could still not completely believe, Roland seized Sleitman around the neck in the crook of one arm, then yanked him forward. The move simultaneously cut off the flow of the man's accusations and drew him close. "Listen to me," Roland said, "and listen well. I care nothing for your life or honor. One's been misspent and the other's long gone, but your son is dead, and about his honor I care very much. If you don't shut up this second, you worm of creation, I'll shut you up myself. So what would you? It's nothing to me either way. I'll tell him you ran mad at the sight of him, stole my gun out of its holster, and put a bullet in your own head to join him. What would you have? Decide." Eisenhart was badly blown, but still lurching and weaving his way up through the corn, hoarsely calling his wife's name. "Margaret! Margaret! Answer me, dear! Give me a word, I beg you, do!" Roland let go of Sleitman and looked at him sternly. Sleitman turned his awful eyes to Jake. "Did your Din kill my boy in order to be revenged on me? Tell me the truth, so." Jake took a final puff on his cigarette and cast it away. The butt lay smoldering in the dirt next to the dead horse. "Did you even look at him?" he asked Benny's da. "No bullet ever made could do that." Cy Eisenhart's head fell almost on top of him, and Benny crawled out of the ditch from the horror of it. It was a word, he realized, that he had never used out loud, had never needed to use out loud. "They threw two of their sneeches at him. I got one, but—" he swallowed. There was a click in his throat. "The other, I would have, you can, I tried, but—" His face was working. His voice was breaking apart, yet his eyes were dry. And somehow, as terrible as Sleitman's. "I never had a chance at the other one," he finished, then lowered his head and began to sob. Roland looked at Sleitman, his eyebrows raised. "All right," Sleitman said. "I see how 'twas. Yar, tell me, were he brave until then? Tell me, I beg." "He and Jake brought back one of that pair," Eddie said, gesturing to the Tavery twins. "The boy half. He got his foot caught in a hole. Jake and Benny pulled him out, then carried him. Nothing but guts, your boy. Side to side and all the way through the middle." Sleitman nodded. He took the spectacles off his face and looked at them as if he had never seen them before. He held them so before his eyes for a second or two, then dropped them onto the road and crushed them beneath one boot heel. He looked at Roland and Jake almost apologetically. "I believe I've seen all I need to," he said, and then went to his son. Vaughn Eisenhart emerged from the corn. He saw his wife and gave a bellow. Then he tore open his shirt and began pounding his right fist above his flabby left breast, crying her name each time he did it. "Oh, man," Eddie said. "Roland, you ought to stop that." "Not I," said the gunslinger. Sleitman took his son's severed arm and planted a kiss in the palm with a tenderness Eddie found nearly unbearable. He put the arm on the boy's chest, then walked back toward them. Without the glasses, his face looked naked and somehow unformed.
Jake, would you help me find a blanket?
Jake got off the wagon wheel to help him find what he needed. In the uncovered trench that had been the hide, Eisenhart was cradling his wife's burnt head to his chest, rocking it. From the corn, approaching, came the children and their minders singing the rice song. At first, Eddie thought that what he was hearing from town must be an echo of that singing. And then he realized it was the rest of the Kala. They knew. They had heard the singing, and they knew. They were coming. Per Callahan stepped out of the field with Leah Jaffords cradled in his arms. In spite of the noise, the little girl was asleep. Callahan looked at the heaps of dead wolves, took one hand from beneath the little girl's bottom, and drew a slow, trembling cross in the air.
God be thanked, he said.
Roland went to him and took the hand that had made the cross.
Put one on me, he said.
Callahan looked at him, uncomprehending. Roland nodded to Von Eisenhart. That one promised I'd leave town with his curse on me if harm came to his wife. He could have said more, but there was no need. Callahan understood and signed the cross on Roland's brow. The fingernail trailed a warmth behind it that Roland felt a long time. And although Eisenhart never kept his promise, the gunslinger was never sorry that he'd asked the pair for that extra bit of protection.
20. What followed was a confused jubilee there on the East Road, mingled with grief for the two who had fallen. Yet even the grief had a joyful light shining through it. No one seemed to feel that the losses were in any way equal to the gains. And Eddie supposed that was true. If it wasn't your wife or your son who had fallen, that was. The singing from town drew closer. Now they could see rising dust. In the road, men and women embraced. Someone tried to take Margaret Eisenhart's head away from her husband, who for the time being refused to let it go. Eddie drifted over to Jake.
Never saw Star Wars, did you? He asked.
No, told you, I was going to, but you left too soon, I know. Those things they were swinging, Jake, they were from that movie.
You sure?
Yes, and the wolves. Jake, the wolves themselves.
Jake was nodding very slowly. Now they could see the people from town. The newcomers saw the children, all the children, still here and still safe, and raised a cheer. Those in the forefront began to run.
I know.
Do you? Eddie asked.
His eyes were almost bleeding.
Do you, really? Because, man, it's so crazy.
Jake looked at the heaped wolves, the green hoods, the gray leggings, the black boots, the snarling, decomposing faces. Eddie had already pulled one of those rotting metal faces away and looked at what was beneath it. Nothing but smooth metal. Plus lenses that served as eyes, a round mesh grill that doubtless served as a nose, two sprouted microphones at the temples for ears. No, all the personality these things had was in the masks and clothing they wore.
Crazy or not, I know what they are, Eddie. Or where they come from, at least. Marvel Comics.
A look of sublime relief filled Eddie's face. He bent and kissed Jake on the cheek. A ghost of a smile touched the boy's mouth. It wasn't much, but it was a start.
The Spider-Man books, Eddie said. When I was a kid, I couldn't get enough of those things.
I didn't buy them myself, Jake said.
But Timmy Mucci down at Midtown Lanes used to have a terrible Jones for the Marvel mags. Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, Captain America, all of them. These guys, they look like Dr. Doom, Eddie said.
Yeah. Jake said. It's not exact. I'm sure the masks were modified to make them look a little more like wolves, but otherwise, same green hoods, same green cloaks. Yeah, Dr. Doom.
And the Sneetches, Eddie said. Have you ever heard of Harry Potter?
I don't think so. Have you?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because the Sneetches are from the future, maybe from some Marvel comic book that'll come out in 1990 or 1995. Do you see what I'm saying?
Jake nodded.
It's all 19, isn't it?
Yeah, Jake said. 19? 99, and 1999.
Eddie glanced around. Where's Suze?
Probably went after her chair, Jake said.
But before either of them could explore the question of Susanna Dean's whereabouts any further, and by then it was probably too late anyway, the first of the Falcon from town arrived. Eddie and Jake were swept into a wild, impromptu celebration, hugged, kissed, shaken by the hand, laughed over, wept over, thanked and thanked and thanked.
21. 10 minutes after the main body of the townsfolk arrived, Rosalita reluctantly approached Roland. The gunslinger was extremely glad to see her. Eben Took had taken him by the arms and was telling him over and over again, endlessly it seemed, how wrong he and Telford had been, how utterly and completely wrong, and how when Roland and his quartet were ready to move on, Eben Took would outfit them from stem to stern and not a penny would they pay.
"Roland," Rosa said.
Roland excused himself and took her by the arm, leading her a little way up the road. The wolves had been scattered everywhere and were now being mercilessly looted of their possessions by the laughing, deliriously happy Falcon. Stragglers were arriving every minute. "Rosa, what is it?"
"It's your lady," Rosa said. "Susanna."
"What of her?" Roland asked. Frowning, he looked around. He didn't see Susanna, couldn't remember when he had last seen her. When he'd given Jake the cigarette that long ago? He thought so. "Where is she?"
"That's just it," Rosa said. "I don't know, so I peeked into the wagon she came in, thinking that perhaps she'd gone in there to rest. That perhaps she felt faint or got sick, do you? But she's not there, and Roland, her chair is gone."
"Gods!" Roland snarled and slammed his fist against his leg. "Oh, gods!" Rosalita took a step back from him, alarmed. "Where's Eddie?" Roland asked. She pointed. Eddie was so deep in a cluster of admiring men and women that Roland didn't think he would have seen him, but for the child riding on his shoulders. It was Hedon Jaffords, an enormous grin on his face.
"Are you sure you want to disturb him?" Rosa asked timidly. "Maybe she's just gone off a bit to pull herself back together."
Gone off a bit, Roland thought. He could feel a blackness filling his heart, his sinking heart. She'd gone off a bit, all right. And he knew who had stepped in to take her place. Their attention had wandered in the aftermath of the fight, Jake's grief, the congratulations of the Falcon, the confusion and the joy and the singing. But that was no excuse.
"Gunslingers," he roared, and the jubilant crowd quieted at once.
Had he cared to look, he could have seen the fear that lay just beneath their relief and adulation. It would not have been new to him. They were always afraid of those who came wearing the hard calibers. What they wanted of such when the shooting was done was to give them a final meal, perhaps a final gratitude fuck, then send them on their way and pick up their own peaceful farming tools once more. "Well," Roland thought, "we'll be going soon enough. In fact, one of us has gone already. Gods! Gunslingers, to me! To me!" Eddie reached Roland first. He looked around. "Where's Susanna?" he asked. Roland pointed into the stony wasteland of bluffs and arroyos, then elevated his finger until it was pointing at a black hole just below the skyline. "I think there," he said. All the color had drained out of Eddie Dean's face.
"That's Doorway Cave you're pointing at," he said, "isn't it?"
Roland nodded.
"But the ball, Black 13. She wouldn't even go near it when it was in Callahan's church."
"No," Roland said, "Susanna wouldn't. But she's not in charge anymore."
"Mia?"
Jake asked.
"Yes."
Roland studied the high hole with his faded eyes. "Mia's gone to have her baby. She's gone to have her chap."
"No,"
Eddie said. His hands wandered out and took hold of Roland's shirt. Around them, the Falcon stood silently, watching.
"Roland, say no!"
"We'll go after her and hope we're not too late," Roland said. But in his heart, he knew they already were.
1. The Doorway Cave.
1. They moved fast, but Mia moved faster. A mile beyond the place where the arroyo path divided, they found her wheelchair. She had pushed it hard, using her strong arms to give it a savage beating against the unforgiving terrain. Finally,
it had struck a jutting rock hard enough to bend the left-hand wheel out of true and render the chair useless. It was a wonder, really, that she had gotten as far in it as she had.
"Fuck Kamala," Eddie murmured, looking at the chair.
At the dents and dings and scratches, then he raised his head, cupped his hands around his mouth, and shouted,
"Fighter, Susanna! Fighter! We're coming!"
He pushed past the chair and headed on up the path, not looking to see if the others were following.
"She can't make it up the path to the cave, can she?" Jake asked. "I mean, her legs are gone."
"Wouldn't think so, would you?" Roland asked, but his face was dark, and he was limping. Jake started to say something about this, then thought better of it.
"What would she want up there, anyway?" Callahan asked.
Roland turned a singularly cold eye on him. "To go somewhere else," he said. "Surely you see that much. Come on."
2. As they neared the place where the path began to climb, Roland caught up to Eddie. The first time he put his hand on the younger man's shoulder, Eddie shook it off. The second time he turned, reluctantly, to look at his din. Roland saw there was blood spattered across the front of Eddie's shirt. He wondered if it was Benny's, Margaret's, or both.
"May happen it'd be better to let her alone a while if it's Mia," Roland said.
"Are you crazy? Did fighting the wolves loosen your screws?"
"If we let her alone, she may finish her business and be gone." Even as he spoke the words, Roland doubted them.
"Yeah," Eddie said, studying him with burning eyes. "She'll finish her business, all right. First piece, have the kid. Second piece, kill my wife."
"That would be suicide."
"But she might do it. We have to go after her."
Surrender was an art Roland practiced rarely, but with some skill on the few occasions in his life when it had been necessary. He took another look at Eddie Dean's pale, set face and practiced it now.
"All right," he said, "but we'll have to be careful. She'll fight to keep from being taken. She'll kill if it comes to that. You before any of us, mayhap."
"I know," Eddie said. His face was bleak.
He looked up the path, but a quarter of a mile up, it hooked around to the south side of the bluff and out of sight. The path zigged back to their side, just below the mouth of the cave. That stretch of the climb was deserted, but what did that prove? She could be anywhere. It crossed Eddie's mind that she might not even be up there at all, that the crashed chair might have been as much a red herring as the children's possessions Roland had had scattered along the arroyo path.
"I won't believe that. There's a million rat holes in this part of the Kala, and if I believe that she could be in any of them..."
Callahan and Jake had caught up and stood there looking at Eddie.
"Come on," he said. "I don't care who she is, Roland. If four able-bodied men can't catch one no-legs lady, we ought to turn in our guns and call it a day."
Jake smiled wanly.
"I'm touched. You just called me a man. Don't let it go to your head, Sunshine. Come on."
3. Eddie and Susanna spoke and thought of each other as man and wife. But he hadn't exactly been able to take a cab over to Cartier's and buy her a diamond and a wedding band. He'd once had a pretty nice high school class ring, but that he'd lost in the sand at Coney Island during the summer he turned 17, the summer of Mary Jean Sobieski. Yet on their journeyings from the Western Sea, Eddie had rediscovered his talent as a woodcarver. "Whittle baby-ass whittler," the great sage and eminent junkie would have said. And Eddie had carved his beloved a beautiful ring of willow green, light as foam but strong. This Susanna had worn between her breasts, hung on a length of rawhide. They found it at the foot of the path, still on its rawhide loop. Eddie picked it up, looked at it grimly for a moment, then slipped it over his own head inside his own shirt.
"Look," Jake said.
They turned to a place just off the path. Here, in a patch of scant grass, was a track. Not human, not animal. Three wheels in a configuration that made Eddie think of a child's tricycle.
"What the hell?"
"Come on," he said, and wondered how many times he'd said it since realizing she was gone. He also wondered how long they'd keep following him if he kept on saying it. Not that it mattered. He'd go on until he had her again or until he was dead. Simple as that. What frightened him most was the baby, what she called the chap. Suppose it turned on her, and he had an idea it might do just that.
"Eddie,"
Roland said. Eddie looked over his shoulder and gave him Roland's own impatient twirl of the hand. Let's go. Roland pointed at the track instead. This was some sort of motor.
Did you hear one?
No.
Then you can't know that.
But I do, Roland said. Someone sent her a ride. Or something.
You can't know that, goddamn you. Andy could have left a ride for her, Jake said, if someone told him to. Who would have told him to do a thing like that? Eddie rasped.
Finley, Jake thought. Finley Otega, whoever he is.
Or maybe Walter.
But he said nothing. Eddie was upset enough already. Roland said, she's gotten away. Prepare yourself for it.
Go fuck yourself, Eddie snarled and turned to the path leading upward. Come on!
4. Yet in his heart, Eddie knew Roland was right. He attacked the path to the doorway cave not with hope, but with a kind of desperate determination. At the place where the boulder had fallen, blocking most of the path, they found an abandoned vehicle with 3 balloon tires and an electric motor that was still softly humming, a low and constant mmm sound. To Eddie, the gadget looked like one of those funky ATV things they sold at Abercrombie & Fitch. There was a hand grip accelerator and hand grip brakes. He bent close and read what was stamped into the steel of the left one. Squeezy Pie Brakes by North Central Positronics. Behind the bicycle-style seat was a little carry case. Eddie flipped it up and was totally unsurprised to see a 6-pack of Nozzola, the drink favored by discriminating bum hugs everywhere. One can had been taken off the ring. She'd been thirsty, of course. Moving fast made you thirsty, especially if you were in labor.
This came from the place across the river, Jake murmured. The Dogon. If I'd gone out back, I would have seen it parked there, a whole fleet of them, probably. I bet it was Andy.
Eddie had to admit it made sense. The Dogon was clearly an outpost of some sort, probably one that predated the current unpleasant residence of Thunderclap. This was exactly the sort of vehicle you'd want to make patrols on, given the terrain. From this vantage point beside the fallen boulder, Eddie could see the battleground where they'd stood against the wolves, throwing plates and lead. That stretch of East Road was so full of people it made him think of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. The whole collar was out there partying, and oh, how Eddie hated them in that moment. My wife's gone because of you chicken shit motherfuckers, he thought. It was a stupid idea. Stupendously unkind as well, yet it offered a certain hateful satisfaction. What was it that poem by Stephen Crane had said, the one they'd read back in high school? I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart. Something like that. Close enough for government work. Now Roland was standing beside the abandoned, softly humming trike. And if it was sympathy he saw in the gunslinger's eyes, or worse, pity, he wanted none of it.
Come on, you guys, let's find her.
5. This time, the voice that greeted them from the doorway cave's depths belonged to a woman Eddie had never actually met, although he had heard of her, aye, much, say thank you, and knew her voice at once.
She's gone, you great dick-led galoot, cried Rhea of the Coos from the darkness. Taken her labor elsewhere, you can, and I've no doubt that when her cannibal baby finally comes out, it'll munch its mother north from the cunt, aye.
She laughed a perfect and perfectly grating witch-hazel cackle.
No titty milk for this one, you grubbet-lost lad. This one'll have meat.
Shut up, Eddie screamed into the darkness. Shut up, you fucking phantom.
And for a wonder, the phantom did. Eddie looked around. He saw Tower's goddamned 2-shelf bookcase, first editions under glass, may they do you fine, but no pink metal mesh bag with Midworld Lanes printed on it. No engraved ghostwood box, either. The unfound door was still here, its hinges still hooked to nothing, but now it had a strangely dull look, not just unfound, but unremembered. Only one more useless piece of a world that had moved on.
No, Eddie said. No, I don't accept that. The power is still here. The power is still here.
He turned to Roland, but Roland wasn't looking at him. Incredibly, Roland was studying the books. as if the search for Susanna had begun to bore him and he was looking for a good read to pass the time. Eddie took Roland's shoulder, turned him. "What happened, Roland? Do you know?"
"What happened is obvious," Roland said.
Callahan had come up beside him. Only Jake, who was visiting the doorway cave for the first time, hung back at the entrance. She took her wheelchair as far as she could, then went on her hands and knees to the foot of the path, no mean feat for a woman who's probably in labor. At the foot of the path, someone, probably Andy, just as Jake says, left her a ride. "If it was Sleitman, I'll go back and kill her myself." Roland shook his head. "Not Sleitman." But Sleitman might know for sure, he thought. It probably didn't matter, but he liked loose ends no more than he liked crooked pictures hanging on walls.
"Hey, bro, sorry to tell you this, but your poke bitch is dead,"
Henry Dean called up from deep in the cave. He didn't sound sorry. He sounded gleeful.
"Damn thing ate her all the way up, only stopped long enough on its way to the brain to spit out her teeth."
"Shut up," Eddie screamed.
"The brain's the ultimate brain food, you know," Henry said. He had assumed a mellow, scholarly tone. "Revered by cannibals the world over. That's quite the chap she's got, Eddie. Cute but hungry." "Be still in the name of God," Callahan cried, and the voice of Eddie's brother ceased.
For the time being, at least, all the voices ceased. Roland went on as if he had never been interrupted. "She came here, took the bag, opened the box so that Black 13 would open the door. Mia, this is, not Susanna, but Mia. Daughter of none. And then, still carrying the open box, she went through. On the other side, she closed the box, closing the door, closing it against us."
"No,"
Eddie said, and grabbed the crystal doorknob with the rose etched into its geometric facets. It wouldn't turn. There was not so much as a single iota of give. From the darkness, Elmer Chambers said,
"If you'd been quicker, son, you could have saved your friend. It's your fault,"
and fell silent again.
"It's not real, Jake,"
Eddie said, and rubbed a finger across the rose. The tip of his finger came away dusty, as if the unfound door had stood here, unused as well as unfound, for a score of centuries. "It just broadcasts the worst stuff it can find in your own head."
"I was always hating your guts, honky,"
Detta cried triumphantly from the darkness beyond the door. "Ain't I glad to be shed of you?"
"Like that,"
Eddie said, cocking a thumb in the direction of the voice. Jake nodded, pale and thoughtful. Roland, meanwhile, had turned back to Tower's bookcase. "Roland?" Eddie tried to keep the irritation out of his voice, or at least add a little spark of humor to it, and failed at both.
"Are we boring you here?"
"No," Roland said.
"Then I wish you'd stop looking at those books and help me think of a way to open this
I know how to open it," Roland said. "The first question is, where will it take us now that the ball is gone? The second question is, where do we want to go? After Mia, or to the place where Tower and his friend are hiding from Balazar and his friends?"
"We go after Susanna," Eddie shouted. "Have you been listening to any of the shit those voices are saying? They're saying it's a cannibal. My wife could be giving birth to some kind of a cannibal monster right now, and if you think anything's more important than that..."
"The Tower's more important," Roland said. "And somewhere on the other side of this door there's a man whose name is Tower, a man who owns a certain vacant lot and a certain rose growing there." Eddie looked at him uncertainly. So did Jake and Callahan. Roland turned again to the little bookcase. It looked strange indeed here in this rocky darkness. "And he owns these books," Roland mused. "He risked all things to save them."
"Yeah, because he's one obsessed motherfucker."
"Yet all things serve Ka and follow the beam," Roland said, and selected a volume from the upper shelf of the bookcase. Eddie saw it had been placed in there upside down, which struck him as a very un-Calvin Tower thing to do. Roland held the book in his seamed, weather-chapped hands, seeming to debate which one to give it to. He looked at Eddie, looked at Callahan, and then gave the book to Jake. "Read me what it says on the front," he said. "The words of your world make my head hurt. They swim to my eye easily enough, but when I reach my mind toward them, most swim away again." Jake was paying little attention. His eyes were riveted on the book jacket with its picture of a little country church at sunset. Callahan, meanwhile, had stepped past him in order to get a closer look at the door standing here in the gloomy cave. At last the boy looked up.
"But, Roland, isn't this the town Père Callahan told us about, the one where the vampire broke his cross and made him drink his blood?"
Callahan whirled away from the door.
"What?"
Jake held the book out wordlessly. Callahan took it, almost snatched it.
"Salem's Lot," he read. "A novel by Stephen King."
He looked up at Eddie, then at Jake.
"Heard of him? Either of you? He's not from my time, I don't think."
Jake shook his head. Eddie began to shake his as well, and then he saw something.
"That church," he said. "It looks like the Kala Gathering Hall. Close enough to be its twin, almost.
It also looks like the East Stoneham Methodist Meeting Hall, built in 1819,
Callahan said. "So I guess this time we've got a case of triplets."
But his voice sounded far away to his own ears, as hollow as the false voices which floated up from the bottom of the cave. All at once, he felt false to himself, not real. He felt 19.
6. "It's a joke," part of his mind assured him. "It must be a joke. The cover of this book says it's a novel, so..."
Then an idea struck him, and he felt a surge of relief. It was conditional relief, but surely better than none at all. The idea was that sometimes people wrote make-believe stories about real places. That was it, surely. Had to be. "Look at page 119, Roland said. "I could make out a little of it, but not all. Not nearly enough." Callahan found the page and read this. "In the early days at the seminary, a friend, a father..." He trailed off, eyes racing ahead over the words on the page.
"Go on," Eddie said. "You read it, Father, or I will."
Slowly, Callahan resumed.
"A friend of Father Callahan's had given him a blasphemous cruel work sampler which had sent him into gales of horrified laughter at the time, but which seemed more true and less blasphemous as the years passed. God grant me the serenity to accept what I cannot change, the tenacity to change what I may, and the good luck not to fuck up too often. This in old English script with a rising sun in the background. Now, standing before Danny Glick's mourners, that old credo returned."
The hand holding the book sagged. If Jake hadn't caught it, it probably would have tumbled to the floor of the cave.
"You had it, didn't you?" Eddie said. "You actually had a sampler saying that."
"Frankie Foyle gave it to me," Callahan said.
His voice was hardly more than a whisper.
"Back in seminary. And Danny Glick, I officiated at his funeral. I think I told you that. That was when everything seemed to change somehow."
"But this is a novel. A novel is fiction. How can it..."
His voice suddenly rose to a damned howl. To Roland, it sounded eerily like the false voices that rose up from below.
"Damn it, I'm a real person!"
"Here's the part where the vampire broke your cross," Jake reported. "Together at last," Barlow said, smiling. His face was strong and intelligent and handsome in a sharp, forbidding sort of way. Yet as the light shifted, it seemed...
"Stop,"
Callahan said dully. "It makes my head hurt."
"It says his face reminded you of the boogeyman who lived in your closet when you were a kid, Mr. Flip."
Callahan's face was now so pale, he might have been a vampire's victim himself.
"I never told anyone about Mr. Flip. Not even my mother. That can't be in that book. It just can't be."
"It is," Jake said simply.
"Let's get this straight," Eddie said. "When you were a kid, there was a Mr. Flip, and you did think of him when you faced this particular type 1 vampire, Barlow, correct?"
"Yes, but..."
Eddie turned to the gunslinger.
"Is this getting us any closer to Susanna, do you think?"
"Yes. We've reached the heart of a great mystery. Perhaps the great mystery. I believe the Dark Tower is almost close enough to touch, and if the tower is close, Susanna is too.
Ignoring him, Callahan was flipping through the book. Jake was looking over his shoulder.
"And you know how to open that door?" Eddie pointed at it.
"Yes," Roland said. "I'd need help. But I think the people of Calabrin Sturgis owe us a little help. Don't you?" Eddie nodded.
"All right, then, let me tell you this much. I'm pretty sure I have seen the name Stephen King before, at least once." "On the specials board," Jake said, without looking up from the book. "Yeah, I remember. It was on the specials board the first time we went toe dash."
"Specials board?" Roland asked, frowning.
"Towers specials board," Eddie said. "It was in the window, remember? Part of his whole restaurant of the mind thing?"
Roland nodded.
"But I'll tell you guys something," Jake said, and now he did look up from the book. "The name was there when Eddie and I went Todash, but it wasn't on the board the first time I went in there. The time Mr. Deepnote told me the river riddle, it was someone else's name. It changed, just like the name of the writer on Charlie the Choo-Choo."
"I can't be in a book," Callahan was saying. "I am not a fiction, am I?"
"Roland," it was Eddie. The gunslinger turned to him. "I need to find her. I don't care who's real and who's not. I don't care about Calvin Tower, Stephen King, or the Pope of Rome. As far as reality goes, she's all of it I want. I need to find my wife." His voice dropped. "Help me, Roland."
Roland reached out and took the book in his left hand. With his right, he touched the door. "If she's still alive," he thought. "If we can find her. And if she's come back to herself. If and if and if." Eddie took Roland's arm.
"Please," he said. "Please don't make me try to do it on my own. I love her so much. Help me find her."
Roland smiled. It made him younger. It seemed to fill the cave with its own light. All of Eld's ancient power was in that smile. The power of the white. "Yes," he said. "We go." And then he said again, all the affirmation necessary in this dark place. "Yes."
Author's note and afterword.
The debt I owe to the American Western in the composition of the Dark Tower novels should be clear without my belaboring the point. Certainly the Kala did not come by the final part of its slightly misspelled name accidentally. Yet, it should be pointed out that at least two sources for some of this material aren't American at all. Sergio Leone, A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, etc., was Italian, and Akira Kurosawa, The Seven Samurai, was, of course, Japanese. Would these books have been written without the cinematic legacy of Kurosawa, Leone, Peckinpah, Howard Hawks, and John Sturges? Probably not without Leone, but without the others, I would argue there could be no Leone. I also owe a debt of thanks to Robin Firth, who managed to be there with the right bit of information every time I needed it. And of course, to my wife Tabitha, who is still patiently giving me the time and light and space I need to do this job to the best of my abilities. This book is dedicated to Frank Muller. I want you to know that he has read a number of my books for the audio market, beginning with Different Seasons. I met him at Recorded Books in New York at that time, and we liked each other immediately. It's a friendship that has lasted longer than some of my readers have been alive. In the course of our association, Frank recorded the first four Dark Tower books, and I listened to them, all 60 or so cassettes, while preparing to finish the Gunslinger story. Audio is the perfect medium for such exhaustive preparation because audio insists that you absorb everything. Your hurrying eye, or occasionally tired mind, cannot skip so much as a single word. That was what I wanted, complete immersion in Roland's world, and that was what Frank gave me. He gave me something more as well, something wonderful and unexpected. It was a sense of newness and freshness that I had lost somewhere along the way, a sense of Roland and Roland's friends as actual people with their own vital inner lives. When I say that Frank heard the voices in my head, I'm speaking the literal truth as I understand it. And, like a rather more benign version of the doorway cave, he brought them fully back to life. The remaining books are finished, this one in final draft, the last two in rough, and in large part, I owe that to Frank Muller and his inspired readings. I had hoped to have Frank on board to do the audio readings of the final three Dark Tower books. Unabridged readings, I do not allow abridgments of my work and don't approve of them, as a rule, and he was eager to do them. We discussed the possibility at a dinner in Bangor during October of 2001, and in the course of the conversation, he called the Tower stories his absolute favorites. As he had read over 500 novels for the audio market, I was extremely flattered. Less than a month after that dinner and that optimistic, forward-looking discussion, Frank suffered a terrible motorcycle accident on a highway in California. It happened only days after discovering he was to become a father for the second time. He was wearing his brain bucket, and that probably saved his life. Motorcyclists, please take note. But he suffered serious injuries nevertheless, many of them neurological. He won't be recording the final Dark Tower novels on tape after all. Frank's final work will almost certainly be his inspired reading of Clive Barker's Cold Heart Canyon, which was completed in September of 2001, just before his accident. Barring a miracle, Frank Muller's working life is over. His work of rehabilitation, which is almost sure to be lifelong, has only begun. He'll need a lot of care and a lot of professional help. Such things cost money, and money's not a thing which, as a rule, freelance artists have a great deal of. I and some friends have formed a foundation to help Frank, and hopefully other freelance artists of various types who suffer similar cataclysms. All the income I receive from the audio version of Wolves of the Kala will go into this foundation's account. It won't be enough, but the work of funding the Wave Dancer Foundation, Wave Dancer was the name of Frank's sailboat, like Frank's rehabilitative work, is only beginning. If you've got a few bucks that aren't working and want to help ensure the future of the Wave Dancer Foundation, don't send them to me. Send them to the Wave Dancer Foundation, care of Mr. Arthur Green, 101 Park Avenue, New York, New York, 10001. That's 10001. Frank's wife, Erica, says thank you. So do I. And Frank would, if he could. Bangor, Maine, December 15th, 2002.
The Dark Tower 5, Wolves of the Kala, was written by Stephen King. It was read by George Guidel, with an afterword by Stephen King. The recording engineers were Erica Weintraub, Terry Hogan, and Paul Fowley, with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ellen Hurst. The Dark Tower 5, Wolves of the Kala, was produced and directed by Kelly Gilday. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Stephen King's Dreamcatcher, read by Jeffrey DeMunn. The Dark Tower 5, Wolves of the Kala, is available in hardcover from Scribner.